It's time to say goodnight to inefficient night storage heaters. Bulky, unattractive, with no precise control, leaving you boiling in the morning and rather chilly at night. So tune in to Fisher Future Heat, home heating systems that give you a steady, controllable supply of heat 24 hours a day. Search Fisher Future Heat today. Fisher Future Heat. The future is electric. For years and years, heating has meant boilers, and boilers have meant breakdowns. Over here, and over here. Anything but music to your ears. At Fisher Future Heat, we create state-of-the-art home heating systems that we fit, then you forget, with no annual servicing needed and a huge 10-year guarantee. In short, we engineer common sense. Search Fisher Future Heat today. Fisher Future Heat. The future is electric.
Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello, I'm Matt Hansen.
And I'm Tristan Riddell.
And you're listening to the Nerd Party.
Talk nerdy to me.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
Thank you so much for listening, and thank you so much for subscribing. We really appreciate it. We're having a great time doing this podcast, and our contact is getting more and more from our fans, and so we want to thank you so much for speaking with us on Facebook, on Twitter, via email. What we're going to talk about today is our top five favorite directors, but before we get into that, it's been kind of a slow geek news week. I mean, we've had a few trailers released, sneak peeks of pictures. We now know that James McAvoy is going to be playing Bald in X-Men Apocalypse. You know, just like, it's been lots of little stuff like that these past couple of weeks.
Relatively little, although I did see your tweet last night about people already trying to spoil Captain America Civil War.
Oh my, yeah, I don't even want to get into that. I mean, there's so many spoilers for this film already, and it's just started shooting. And so, I mean, I just want to give a blanket statement to people. Stop it. Stop taking pictures of the set. Stop releasing tidbits that you found out because a friend of a friend of a friend is the second assistant cameraman on the film who gave you one of the props. I mean, like, please, just stop trying to be first and just respect other people who want to wait for the actual film.
I mean, I think really, if anyone, I don't even know if it's possible today, but like for anyone to make a film and not have things get out, you really have to like build a Berlin Wall around your sets now.
Like Abrams did, yeah.
And even Abrams couldn't manage it. I mean, like he tried his best, but.
Yeah. Well, so there's been just little bits and tidbits of news like that. But one thing did happen, and the internet lost its mind. It went absolutely crazy over a film release, and that is Mad Max Fury Road. Now, before we get into what we're going to talk about, now, I have not seen the film, and so I cannot critique it on any merits whatsoever, and I'm not going to. Now, Matt, you have seen the film.
I did.
And before we get into your comments on it, and this is going to be a spoiler-free review,
yes,
from Matt, from our good friend and co-host, Matt. So those of you who haven't seen it yet, you know, you can continue on and don't worry about it. Here's the thing. The internet lost its mind because apparently, like, when I saw that this film was coming out, I was like, oh, cool. They're doing a continuation of Mad Max, and they're going to recast it. That's fun. That's cool. I've never been in love with the property. You know, that's fine. Mad Max, whatever. Mel Gibson, woohoo. You know, action film, post-apocalyptic, whatever. And when I saw this film, I didn't think anything of it. I was like, okay, another action film. And then it was released. It currently holds a 99% on Rotten Tomatoes, and people are calling it a masterpiece and, surprisingly, the feminist movie of the year. With all of that in mind, and regardless of Twitter reaction and Facebook reaction, online reaction, everything like that, let's first off talk about what you thought of the movie, and then we can go through and analyze what other people might think of what you thought of the movie.
Yeah, so I heard all this great buzz going in, like masterpiece. That not only masterpiece, I saw not one but many reactions that said, best action movie of all time. Not of the decade, not even of this year, of all time. And the fact that it has a 99% puts it ahead of like many other classic action films or films that we now consider classics. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like the greatest that film has to offer. So, I mean, that's a really high thing to say going in. And I have to be honest, when I went to go see it, I saw the other film. I watched the other films for the first time leading up to it. They were good, but I was never that impressed with them. They're hard to get into because, and I think this holds true for this new film as well. In all of these Mad Max films where his name's in the title, he's never the most interesting character. Mm. Never. It's usually the villains or other side characters that tend to steal the spotlight. So going into this, I went on Friday. It was a fairly populated theater. Saw the film, and I thought that, well, I think the action's really great. It looks great. It's filmed really well. I personally didn't think it was the best action movie of all time. I thought it was good. I thought it was a very well put together film, was well directed, considering that it's the same director from the first three films, and he's in his 70s at this point. So that is really impressive. I'm not trying to take away from that. The fact that a lot of the stunts were supposedly practical is cool. Kind of left feeling like I really don't understand why it's this built up.
That's pretty high expectations to go into a film when everyone and their mom is saying it's the greatest action film of all time. It's kind of hard not to be let down by that, right?
I guess so, but you know, some of the stuff that I said that I've been reading about this film, it's like, yeah, but it just seems to me that the things that people are crediting this film with, so practical stunts, they're very good, but I don't think that. And this sounds very pretentious, but I don't think that a film becomes the greatest action film of all time simply because it relied more on practical stunts than CGI. We've had a show about this where, mm-hmm. CGI, practical stunts are cool when you can use them. And like I said, they look good, but using CGI action doesn't make a film lesser in my eyes. You know, and maybe that's just me, but the practical effects used in this film are cool, but they're very, very repetitive. It's a lot of cars crashing. It's a lot of explosions. And it's very, very high on action, but for me personally, light on story.
That's what I was going to ask you about. I mean, everybody's talking about the action. Everyone's talking about the practical effects and how it's a tour de force, as people love to say, and how George Miller is back in his game and everything like that. But what about, no one's talking about the story. No one is talking about the story elements or if it's dramatic or if it's compelling. Everyone's just saying, it's amazing. That's all that they're saying. It's amazing. It's action packed, but no one's talking about the story. Perhaps maybe except the feminist angle. I mean, like, which do you want to talk about first? Do you want to talk about the feminist angle? Or do you want to talk about what you thought of the story?
Well, let me talk about the feminist angle real quick, because I will say that I didn't totally dislike this movie, because I think the most interesting thing about the movie is Charlize Theron and the role that she plays. She is way more interesting than Tom Hardy could be. I mean, first of all, Tom Hardy doesn't have very much to say in the movie. He has about maybe 30 lines of dialogue mm-hmm. in the whole 2 hours. And I don't know if it was just me, but it's because of the accent he's trying to put on, he sounded like he was mumbling a lot. Like, I couldn't understand half of the things he was saying when he was talking. And just very stoic. And I don't know what it is with him. I mean, I want to like him, and I have liked him in other things, but he's never been the most interesting draw for me in any of his films.
Yeah.
She, on the other hand, was pretty cool. I liked her because she was a strong female. And yes, I could see where the feminist praise is coming from. I'm not saying that it's unwarranted. What I think is being blown a little bit out of proportion, in my opinion, is that the fact that this is some game-changing film for feminists. Yeah, there's very strong female characters, especially Charlize, but there's nothing that this film does that hasn't been done in other films with other action female leads with, quite frankly, I think better stories. So I don't know why this one is being held as the pinnacle of modern filmmaking. It's like we forgot that those other films happened and existed. Now, do I think they're bringing it back to a modern audience? Yeah, I think that's possible. We haven't seen a lot of that lately, and so it's good to see. I give it full marks for that. But to say that this is some sort of game changer and this has never been done before, I take issue with stuff like that. It's been done before, but
yeah, I think you might be right there. And again, to the listeners, I have not seen this yet. But I think you might have it there where it's been done before, and I think introducing a movie that has feminist ties, or at least strong female characters, and not just strong female characters as in like they can handle a gun or they can punch out a guy three times their size, but strong in character and strong as in real, as in realistic, not just vapid. I think the reason why people are grabbing onto it so heavily right now is because it's being introduced in this climate. If you look at the feminist climate as of today, as opposed to how it was 10 years ago, it's much stronger and much more vocal. And I think it's something that people, it's something new that people can latch onto.
But I think that it's being latched on, and again, I love strong female characters. I think that they're some of my favorite movie characters of all time. Mm-hmm. But just because you have the presence of a strong female doesn't mean that in my view, the film should win automatic points just because it has that, which from my perspective, that's what it seems to be. Is like, if you have a strong female that is just an action heroine and she must not be in any sort of relationship. She must be totally independent and, she can kick butt. That's enough these days for like very strong pro-feminist voices to latch onto and say that it's, one for the ages. And she's, as far as Charlize Theron goes, her character's not fun, because I don't think a lot in this movie was fun per se, except for maybe some of the action sequences. But she's the most interesting. She does have more of a character arc than most of the other people in this movie. Mm-hmm. But it's still the focus is so much on the action, and there's such a kinetic feel to this movie that she has the most character development, but it's thin at best. Like, you don't find out a whole lot about her. You find out some backstory, and that's cool. I liked that, but it doesn't leave much for arcs. It doesn't leave much for character development. It's so focused on the filmmaking and the action spectacle that I think it lost points with me there in terms of. I liked the action that was going on. I was never that invested in the characters, though, and that's a big thing for me when I go see an action movie, is I have to love the characters, or at least want them to succeed.
Absolutely, absolutely. All right. Well, I think if I could sum this up for you, even though you're better at the summaries than I am, is that it was a great action film with great practical effects. The story was a little weak. The characterization was okay, but it's nothing that we haven't seen before.
Right, and I think it. I'm probably going to get a lot of heat for this because I've seen online that anyone who is going against, and there's a minority, obviously this film is connected with a lot of people, but anyone who really goes against is being accused of having poor taste or not being anti-women. Mm-hmm. Or the fact that right now with the box office, Mad Max came in number two and Pitch Perfect 2 came in at number one. Everyone is like, well, there's no accounting for taste in America. People will enjoy crap and just go to see crap whenever it comes out, and they'll forget about, they won't go to these, masterclass films. And I mean, I had my own feelings about the film, but when I hear stuff like that and there's such negativity when trying to promote a film that people like, I get being passionate about films, but if you have to do it at the derision of moviegoers and other films, it makes me want to like the film less. And I know I shouldn't, but it does have that effect on me, unfortunately.
Yeah, I'm glad that you brought this up, because I kind of feel that this is very similar to what happened with Avengers Age of Ultron, where it was very divisive and I didn't expect it to be. It was funny because on our Facebook page, we had a conversation with a good friend of the show. He was like, he made a comment. He's like, yeah, I'm so sick of this. And we asked, like, are you sick of Age of Ultron or our take on it? And he said, kind of both. And we had a very polite, nice conversation between us. He said that he felt like, just because he didn't like Age of Ultron, that all he was getting was fan hate. And both Matt, you and I have felt the exact opposite, where because we were so all about Age of Ultron, all we were getting were people saying, ugh, you know, whatever, it was a horrible movie, why on earth would you like that? And it's so funny because people who liked the film felt like only, like, people who hated it were dogging them, and people who hated the film felt like people who liked it were dogging them. So it was so funny to see that kind of perspective. And when you have Mad Max, you have such a vocal majority, and you have a minority who says that they didn't like it, they automatically lump them together with people who have pettiness. Now, you came up with a very thought-out argument, and you compared it with movies that you've seen in the past and what you like from movies in the past, and you know that there's going to be people who lump you in together with, like, the quote-unquote men's rights activists, you know, or the people who hate feminists, or the people who are just mad that this is getting more positive reaction than a Marvel movie. You know, like, it's just like, no, it's okay to not like a movie that everybody else likes, as long as you have reasoning behind it that isn't petty, like the men's rights activists.
I mean, yeah, that is petty, and let me just be clear, I'm not that at all, and I know you weren't accusing me of being. I just want to make that clear to the listeners, and I'll be perfectly honest with you at this point. Yes, I did like Age of Ultron more than Mad Max, but that's only because, you know, I was already a fan. It did more for me in terms of story. Yes, the story has its own problems, which we acknowledged when we did our review. But I'm more what was the thing for me is I'm more invested in those characters.
Yeah.
Mad Max, with all the movies, it's kind of hard to invest because they all have such a different flavor that, and they don't spend any time really delving into the title character, so it's hard to like him or be invested with him in the same way. I mean, I watched that third one, and the most interesting character in it is Tina Turner. It's not Mel Gibson. So, you know, it's just harder for me to go along with that. But that's just my personal taste in movies. I'm not one who's automatically going to be blown away by practical effects or the presence of a strong woman. I think those things are good, but it needs to go further than just that.
I hear you. All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us. And so I feel like, as that is our intro topic, I feel like we should go into something that is all pure love now, because it's something that you and I greatly appreciate, and that is a good director. And what we're talking about is our top five directors that we love. Okay, so it's our favorite directors. As we say every single time, this is not saying these are the top five directors of all time. This is not the top five greatest filmmakers in America or in the world. These are Tristan's top five directors and Matt's top five directors. That's it. Beginning and end. Right there. Boom. Okay, so I know that whenever you make a director's list online, no matter who you put in it, you could make a list of 2,000 directors from the beginning of time, and people would say, this list is bullshit.
Or you miss that person, you miss this person.
You miss that person, you miss this person. Why on earth is Tim Burton above Spike Lee? You know, you'll hear that kind of crap all the time. So we're stating right at the beginning, folks, this is who we love and why, not who is great and why.
Right. So with that said, I think if I'm keeping track of everything correctly, Tristan, I went first during our last top five. So it's your turn to go first on this top five.
All right, well, I will go first, and I'm glad that you're keeping track because I completely forgot. Okay, so in descending order from 5 to 1, number 5, and I do have some honorable mentions because this was a hard list to make.
Yeah.
Number 5 is Wes Anderson. I know a lot of people out there love Wes Anderson. He's very popular, but I know that there's a lot of people out there as well who don't like Wes Anderson. They feel like he is very much style over substance. Wes Anderson is Bottle Rocket, Rushmore, Royal Tenenbaums, Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, The Darjeeling Limited, Fantastic Mr. Fox, Moonrise Kingdom, and The Grand Budapest Hotel.
Okay, he's the one who did Grand Budapest. Okay.
Anyway, so Wes Anderson. Yeah, a lot of people say he's style over substance, and I think that's the lazy man's argument. I really do, because just because you have a distinct style that's easily recognizable and you can pinpoint it from the first frame, you're like, oh, bam, one frame, that's a Wes Anderson film. Or you hear the music, you're like, that's a Wes Anderson film. It doesn't mean that it's a bad move. It doesn't mean that just because it's stylistic that it's negative. And there is a essence to his films that is very, very much appealing. The thing about this list, and you and I talked about this before we recorded, that when we make this list, it doesn't mean that we love every single film that these directors have done, because that's very, by far, not the truth. And it's also like where it's, we don't feel like this director can do no wrong, because one of my favorite movies of all time is The Royal Tenenbaums, and as well as The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou. I think these are fantastic films where I could watch them once a week and never get over them. I mean, and like, and granted, that's partly because of the power of Bill Murray in Life Aquatic, but and also Gene Hackman in Royal Tenenbaums, along with Angelica Houston. But when I saw Grand Budapest Hotel, I was like, I saw it in the theater. I was like, okay, that's just an okay movie. I probably won't hear that about that too terribly much. And then I bought the Blu-ray because I was like, okay, well, like a lot of times with Wes Anderson films, you got to give it a couple of watches before it really sticks with you. I watched it again and I was just like, nope, don't like it any more than I did the first time. And then all of a sudden it got nominated for Best Picture for Golden Globes, nominated for Best Picture in the Oscars. I was floored. I cannot believe that that's the case. So, and if you like Grand Budapest Hotel, great, more power to you. But I'm just trying to defend myself by saying that I love Wes Anderson, and I love his style, but it doesn't mean I'm a mindless zombie who's just like, oh yes, everything that Wes Anderson does, I'm going to consume. But some of my three favorites would be Royal Tenenbaums, Life Aquatic, and Fantastic Mr. Fox. I love those movies. I could watch them. Those have to be in my top 20 of all time.
I keep hearing so much buzz about, well, ever since it came out, about Fantastic Mr. Fox, and I've never seen it, so I guess I should check it out, considering that it gets such love.
You really should. It's really, really good. It's like it's claymation, and it's really quirky, it's really funny, and the dialogue is fantastic. It has a lot of great actors in it. It has Meryl Streep plays the female protagonist, and George Clooney is the male protagonist, and Bill Murray plays his lawyer, who's a badger. And it's safe enough for kids, but enjoyable for adults, and not like Shrek where they hide dirty jokes, but just it's a solid film from start to finish. And it's very much for our generation. I mean, my wife and I love this movie so much that we wanted to share it with both sets of our parents, and we did, and there was not a single laugh during the entire thing.
So it's not for everybody, or what?
It is not for everybody. It is very much for our generation.
Okay. All right. Well, then I will check it out, because I don't think you've rarely steered me wrong with any of your recommendations.
Have you seen Royal Tenenbaums or Life Aquatic?
No.
Yeah, you need to watch this as well. I mean, like, Darjeeling Limited is okay.
I heard divided things on that one.
Yeah, and Moonrise Kingdom, I didn't like it the first time I saw it, but then I started to enjoy it the more that I watched it. And Rushmore and Bottle Rocket, I just don't like. I mean, I know that there's a lot of hardcore fans out there. Those are his first two films. They're just not for me.
Yeah. And it's like you said, too. I mean, with all the directors on our lists, it would be hard it would be amazing if we loved all of their films. I don't think anyone has a perfect track record.
Somebody on this list might, but...
Well, for you, but...
I've been talking for a long time. So what's your number five?
Okay, my number five is one that maybe would take away some credence from the fact that we didn't pick directors that would necessarily be on top 10 lists. But when I thought about it, and I thought about all the films that I've seen of his throughout my life and how much they had an impact from when I was a kid to when I was, you know, I'm 26 now, so to now, I had a hard time rationalizing why I shouldn't put him on this list, even though he is usually credited as being one of the greatest directors of all time. And so my number five is Steven Spielberg.
Hey, all right. Okay, see, I'm so glad that you put him on your list, because, you know, he's one of those people that people don't want to put on their list because his name is synonymous with directing. And there's so many people out there who that's the only director's name that they know. Like, people who aren't hardcore into movies like we are, that's the only director they know. And so a lot of people say, like, oh, it's too popular to put Steven Spielberg on a list. So I'm really glad that you did, because he completely deserves it.
Yeah, and that's the thing, right? I mean, like, he might be, so his name might be the easiest one to come up with, but there's a reason for that, obviously. And, you know, his past it's been, God, I didn't even realize, but it's been 40 years this year since Jaws came out.
Yep.
And that was his first big one. So I think his really last 40 years have spoken for themselves. And again, you can't have that long a career and not have some stuff that, that everybody didn't like. There's some sort of his movies that I wasn't in love with. But when I think about when I was young and thinking about, you know, the Indiana Jones films or E.T., to when I was older, I mean, I saw Jaws for the first time when I was 11, and it was my favorite movie of all time when I was, you know, that young. I remember the summer that I saw it, I just rented it over and over again from the video store because I loved that movie so much. And, you know, and as I've gotten older, I've actually gotten into more of his recent films and more of his adult fare. I mean, like, I had never seen and I know people don't consider this one of his greats, but I really ended up enjoying it. I never seen Catch Me If You Can until late last year. I just thought I'd rent it because I'm starting to like Leonardo DiCaprio more ever since, you know, his post Departed days. He's gotten really, really mm-hmm. good. So, mm-hmm. but actually, when I saw that movie, Catch Me If You Can, it was released in 2002. I think there's where you see more of the turnaround because he went from, you start to see the actor that he starts evolving into, and then of course Departed, he explodes. But I really ended up enjoying that movie, and I like Tom Hanks, and I like, you know, I like 60s period pieces. So, you know, I'm getting more into more of his films now. And what, just like I said, when you think about the cultural impact that he's had, but even more beyond that, cause these are subjective lists, you know, how much he's impacted my life since childhood, even stuff he didn't direct, but he produced through Amblin.
Yeah.
I mean, like cartoon shows that I've watched, cartoon movies that I've watched, he's had his hand in them. And so I think that's deserving enough to be put on my subjective list, even though I did put him at number five.
He's a fantastic storyteller, and he's one of those people where the power of storytelling and the business side of storytelling, as well as the creative side, it just comes natural to him, where he has obviously has lots of friends in the industry, and people will invite him to their set just to be there and be a force. They're just like, oh, can you just want to visit the set one day? He's like, yeah, sure, I'll see what's going on. And I've heard so many of these stories where they come up to him, they're like, you know, this scene's not working. You know, what do you think? What would you do? And he'll take 5 seconds to think about it. And he's like, well, have you tried looking at it this way? And it'll just blow their minds. And they'll go, holy crap, why didn't we think of that 6 months ago in pre-production? And he saves that scene and gets the actors where they need to be. And he's just like visiting with his coffee, like, oh, hey, have a great day, guys. And then he'll leave. And that's the kind of person that he is. He was built for filmmaking, and he's a fantastic force. I mean, and I just want to list real quick. So like, for those of you who are like, oh yeah, Steven Spielberg, whatever, he's the guy who did The Crystal Skull. No, shut up. Okay. Lincoln, Munich, Minority Report, Saving Private Ryan, Saving Freaking Private Ryan, Schindler's List, Jurassic Park, Indiana Jones,
Close Encounters,
E.T., Close Encounters, E.T., and Jaws. This is all from one man.
Yeah. It's fascinating to me. And then I'm sure, being a movie fan, I'm sure you heard a lot of the behind the scenes filmmaking when he was doing Jaws, and mm-hmm. how that production was so terrible, and he was convinced by the end of it that he would never work again. I love it when stories go like that and they have the complete opposite reaction, and he ends up being one of the best filmmakers of all time.
It's really funny. I mean, like Jaws, I mean, I love Jaws for a long time, and I showed it to Sarah for the first time. And she never saw it, and we watched it just like 2 years ago together.
Really? Oh, for the first time, she never saw it?
She never saw it, and she watched it for the first time. And she, after it's done, she turns to me, and she's like, that's a good-ass movie. And I'm like, yeah, it is. And see, like, it's a movie that was made in 1975, and it transcends time. It transcends special effects. It's a good, solid movie.
The moment that I knew, well, watching that film, the moment that you can tell that Spielberg is a great filmmaker, aside from all the other great stuff that he did, visual-wise and choice-wise, and I'm geeking out about Jaws for a second, but you know when he works really well with actors and he know he just gets emotion, is the whole speech that Robert Shaw gives about the Indianapolis. That is my favorite scene in that entire movie, where he recounts what happened to him in World War II with the Sharks. Mm-hmm. God, is that brilliant, and, you know...
Yeah, he has a fantastic ability and a fantastic talent, and I even like some of his lesser known stuff, or I mean, like things that people might not like. And Like, I loved Hook as a kid. And I really like the movie Always with Richard Dreyfuss in 1989.
Everyone keeps talking about Always. That's the one I haven't seen yet. So I guess I have to see it because some people really like it. Some people really don't like it.
Yeah, it's a movie that a lot of people hate and nobody references with Steven Spielberg. Like in South Park, there was an episode where Steven Spielberg was visiting the town. And they're like, Steven Spielberg is visiting South Park today. And he's a director of such films as Always in 1941. You know?
Yeah.
And you're just like, oh, okay, all right, well, there you go. But I really liked it. So, all right, number four.
For you.
Number four for me, that's right. Okay, well, with me, I really struggled with this one because there are more films of his that I dislike than I like.
Well, this should be interesting.
But I thoroughly enjoy his technique, his voice, his style, how he moves the camera, what he gets out of his actors. I thoroughly enjoy his presence as a director, and he's a huge force in the industry, as well as in film preservation in the industry, which I really appreciate. And that's Martin Scorsese.
That's really interesting. So, like, I haven't seen a whole ton of Scorsese films, but his name does come up with in a lot of the annals of great directors. But he has more films that you dislike rather than like. But okay, so what are the films that you like other than he did Departed, right? Was that him?
That's right. He did The Departed, which, as you know, is one of my favorite films.
Right, right. So, Departed, I know you love Goodfellas. Based on certain extracurricular activities that you did, I know you love Goodfellas.
Yeah, not everybody sees that. Not everybody knows about that one. Yeah, I for those of you who don't know, I did an entry to Turner Classic Movies. You were supposed to present a movie and why you thought it was a great film and a classic movie. And Goodfellas came out in 1990. That's 25 years ago. And a lot of people are like, oh, that's not that long ago. That's 25 years ago. That's a long time. I mean, that could be one of their new classics or something like that. And so I did this most people just kind of stood in front of the camera and talked about why it was such a great film. Some people got more creative. I went in a way of where I did it in the style of Goodfellas, where I narrated my entry and I drove around and reenacted a scene from Goodfellas as I was talking about the movie. And the girl makes an appearance in it as well.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so, okay. So with, like, Departed is one of my favorite films of all time. And Goodfellas is just one of the greatest films of all time.
Mm-hmm.
It was one of those movies that whenever it's on TV, you just have to watch the rest of it. Whether there's 2 hours left of it or 5 seconds left of it, you're just like, I'm going to watch this right now. This is what I'm, like, screw whatever else I'm doing. I get a lot of hate from my film geek friends and my people who I knew in film school and when I lived with a whole bunch of film nerds. I don't like Raging Bull or Taxi Driver. That's just heresy. Like, you're not allowed to say that in the community. And I don't know why. I mean, like, yes, they're classic movies. Yes, they have a voice and they said something. And for that, I appreciate what they did for film history, but I don't like watching them. I don't. You know, like, there's a lot of films that he's made that I don't like. Mean Streets, Taxi Driver and Raging Bull, like I said. After Hours, Color of Money, I didn't like. Cape Fear, The Age of Innocence. Kundun, Bringing Out the Dead. I mean, that's a lot of movies that I don't like. Oh my God, I friggin' hated Shutter Island. Don't even talk to me about Shutter Island.
I forgot that was him.
Yeah, and Hugo was just eh.
That's what I thought about Hugo too. To be honest with you, I appreciated the fact that it was a celebration of film, but I went to go see that in the theater, hearing all the good stuff about it, and I was like, "That's okay." I thought it was way too long, by the way, for a kid's film.
Yes.
Like that felt endless. That movie.
Yeah, it pushed the boundaries technically a lot with its use of Steadicam, its use of 3D and CGI integration. It was very, very well done. And very well-made movie, but just not for me. Now, I'm talking about a lot of negatives of Scorsese, but the thing is, when he gets something right, it is fantastic. Like Goodfellas and The Departed. And I even like the Last Temptation of Christ.
And I just to go against your grain, I do like Cape Fear, but that's because it's my kind of movie.
Well, yeah, that's the thing, is that it's your kind of movie. Like, it's a genre that I don't really like. And then, like, Casino, I didn't like the first time I saw it, but then the more I watched it, I was like, okay, this has value. I like this. This is good. And then Gangs of New York is something special. That is a one-in-a-million type movie. I think all the performances were great. It made Cameron Diaz tolerable, which, I mean, that's hard to do, ladies and gentlemen. And then he follows up Gangs of New York with The Aviator, that is a nice slice of America put down. And then you go from, like, just bing, bang, boom. You had Gangs of New York, Aviator, Departed. Holy crap. 2002, 2004, 2006. Every 2 years, we got a phenomenal Scorsese film. And then he followed it up with Shutter Island. I'm not even going to talk about Wolf of Wall Street. Screw that movie, okay? So we're not even going to talk about that.
Yeah. Another film where, again, didn't get the hype behind it.
Didn't get it. It was trash. And I have no idea how it even made the R rating. I really don't. But
how do you mean how you didn't know how it made the R rating? It's obvious why it made.
No, what I'm saying is that it's beyond R. It's like
this, oh, I see. Gotcha.
That's what I'm saying is that, I mean, this defines hard R. I mean, I don't even know how you can say this is an R rated film. This is beyond it. I have no idea how that made it through the censors, but. But that's not the reason why I dislike the movie. That's one of the big reasons, but it's not the main reason. But anyway, we're not talking about it. But it's just like, yeah, like how he moves the camera, how he introduces his characters, how he tells his stories is phenomenal. And his impact on the industry will be felt for decades, if not longer. And that's why he's number four on this list.
Well, I can't argue with you because a lot of the films that you mentioned are such great films. So... I liked how we had to qualify it with you disliked more than you liked, so that made for interesting conversation.
Yeah, some people might take that as, well, I hate to break it to you, you don't like that director. You're like, no, I love his style and I love what he has to say. It doesn't always touch with me. I mean, and it also means that he explores outside of my comfort zone. It's not just the same movie and over again. He makes different kinds of movies, and I applaud that.
So, like, you with you and Scorsese, you like a smaller number of films than he's made. With my number four, I've only seen a handful of films that this guy has made. I think only about three, maybe three and a half, because I've caught bits and pieces of other ones. But the reason that I'm putting him at number four on the list is because the three that I've seen made such an impact on me and had me thinking about them so far beyond when I saw them. And trying to parse them out in conversations with other people, that it there's something to be said about movies that it can inspire that level of thought and that level of conversation. So my number four on my list is Stanley Kubrick.
Ah, I was wondering if he was going to make your list.
Yeah, so I've probably spoken about him before then on the show, but I don't recall. But you and I are both sci-fi nerds, obviously. Mm-hmm. But I think there's a category of, you know, action sci-fi and hard sci-fi. And when it comes to, like, hard sci-fi, I don't think I like a movie more than 2001 A Space Odyssey. I really don't. And it's I know it's a film that divides a lot of people because it's very existential. It's very minimalist. But the surprising thing is, and my mom was taken aback by this, is that I first saw that movie when I was 11 or 12, and I loved it then. And that's, you wouldn't think that if you've seen 2001 A Space Odyssey, you wouldn't think that that's a movie that an 11 or 12 year old could sit through, or much less understand. But there was something about the way that he used the camera, the way it was minimalist. Parts of that film almost feel like they're horrific because they're so minimalist. I love the fact that he makes the unknown both scary and enticing in that film. It had me thinking about it for years after. To this day, I anytime that it's on TCM, and it's on TCM a lot, I will sit down and watch it, especially if we get to the Discovery scenes, which are my favorite parts of that film, as I think they're the most memorable from that film. But it had such a grand impact on me. And then I saw, of course, being the person that I am and the horror fan that I am, both Clockwork Orange and The Shining, and loved both those films so much. And I think what makes him unique for me is the way he uses the camera in those two films, especially The Shining. Mm-hmm. There are some fantastic ways of making a normal setting, a hotel, that's not really, it's not a creaky hotel. It's not a haunted hotel.
Nope. It's a very nice hotel. Yeah.
It is haunted, but it doesn't look like a haunted hotel is my point.
Your stereotypical hotel in a haunted film.
Right. It's a beautiful place. It's in a picturesque location. And yet he made that, he did so well at making it claustrophobic. He made it very, foreboding. And I, you know, one of my favorite things, if we're just talking about directing style, is, I don't know if you've seen The Shining or not, but there's at one point where he does this great tracking shot of the boy going through the hotel on the big wheel, and then he runs into the two twin girls, and it's one of the most famous scenes in the film. But just the tracking shots of that film are so good, and the performances are... He has this way about bringing out some of the quirkiest performances out of his actors that they're strange, but they fit the film that they're going for. And I think that's really, really phenomenal. I see a lot of people, you know, this might be spoiling one of your later choices, Tristan, but a lot of people compare Nolan to Kubrick these days, mm-hmm. especially with his last film, Interstellar. And I could see the influences, but there's something about Kubrick that just gets to me every time I see one of his films. So even though I've only seen about three, maybe a half, because I've seen bits and pieces of Full Metal Jacket, there's just something about him that entices me. So I think the fact that he inspired this level of thought out of me is why he's on this list.
Well, I think you have very good reasoning there, and I think that's solid. And a lot of people who evoke his name, they can't really back it up, because they say it because they're supposed to say it. But you had good, solid reasons as to why, and for that I appreciate. You know, going to school for film and hearing all of these pretentious bastards talk about Kubrick when they're really just talking nonsense, it drains.
Yeah, you notice I didn't use the A word there. I didn't call him an auteur, although a lot of people will call him that. And you know what? He's one of the few that I think could potentially take that title, only because his films are very unique and he shoots them with his own style. And he does have something. He inspires a lot of conversation, which I don't know a lot of directors do all the time. So that's the only reason why I'm okay, even though I don't like that term being thrown around so frequently. I'm okay with it in this instance because his films are different. They're offbeat somehow.
Now I'm the kind of person who doesn't really like Stanley Kubrick, and I'm not ashamed to say it. But the thing is, he is one of those directors where I appreciate what he's done for film more than his films.
Right.
And I've seen all of his movies, and Spartacus is great, and I am jealous of people who have not yet seen The Shining, because seeing that for the first time is a mind-altering experience.
That seriously it battles 2001. I go back and forth on which one of those I like more.
I actually am one of those people who I actually enjoyed Eyes Wide Shut.
Oh, you did. That's a rare find.
I know. For especially for people who know me personally. You know, they're like, why on earth would you like Eyes Wide Shut? And especially for people who just listened and heard me condemn The Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah, totally.
It's like, that's the thing, is that like, for people who call me a prude who for not liking Wolf of Wall Street, watch Eyes Wide Shut. And like, there, it has very much some of the same content, but it's presented in a very, very different way. I appreciate Eyes Wide Shut more than I like it, if that makes sense. And I think that's the microcosm for me with Stanley Kubrick. And to this day, I've never seen A Clockwork Orange, because I promised my mother when I was 10 years old that I would never see that film, and I have kept my promise. And I don't care who knows it, who makes fun of me, when I read about it or know, and I've heard what's in it, I have zero interest in seeing that.
As much as I love that film, it's one of those where I know you pretty well, I wouldn't recommend it. It's a great film. It's not for you.
yeah, there you go. Like, forever wants to watch it, more power to you, but I can't do it. But I think you chose great. He had to have been on one of our lists, and you gave great reasonings as to why he was on your list.
I hope I gave some pretty good non-pretentious reasons for why he's on my
list. I think you did. Like almost every time I've heard about Stanley Kubrick, there's been some sort of pretentiousness along with it, and you didn't present any of that. So fantastic job, you.
Good. Thank you. Number three for you.
Number three, okay, is very special to me. Most people who like him get called pretentious just for liking his films. He is very much operating on a different level. This is a different kind of filmmaker. He is much more of an art house filmmaker. Mm-hmm. And my number three pick is the main heavy influence on my number two and my number one. That is Terrence Malick.
Yes. Okay. I've not seen any of his films, but yeah, I know the connotations that he carries.
I can't not sound pretentious talking about his films. I really can't.
This is,
so,
by the way, for my clarification, this is the Tree of Life guy, right?
Yes, this is the Tree of Life guy. Okay. So, I'm gonna say this to the listeners. All right. Forgive me for what I'm about to say, because I'm gonna sound very, very pretentious, and that's just how it is. I'm a snobby person.
You went to film school.
I went to film school. I've written papers about this guy, and it's very hard for me not to sound pretentious. So I'm about to. So just forgive me. His movies are an experience. Okay, they are more of an experience than they are a movie, and it's something where you just open up your senses and you let it wash over you. You don't watch a Terrence Malick film. You let it wash over you. You take it in. You don't watch it. That's why I really appreciate these films, because they're ethereal. If you could walk in a cloud, that's what a Terrence Malick film is like. It's something that just grabs you and makes you think, and it makes you feel, and you have no idea why. And Tree of Life is a grand example of that, where you're watching this and you're like, so many people are like, oh, I want my money back. You know, like that totally wasn't what I was expecting. Like people went to see Tree of Life who didn't know who Terrence Malick was, where there was a few theaters who were actually putting up signs saying, we are not issuing refunds for Tree of Life.
I remember that actually, because Tree of Life wasn't too long ago. I think that was like 2011 or something.
Yeah, it was not that long ago whatsoever. And it was exactly in 2011. And that is a phenomenal film. And it's about the creation of the world as well as a family in a small town in Texas. You know, like no other filmmaker can tackle that. About the creation of the universe as well as a man and a woman raising some kids in Texas. You know, like that's you know, and there's dinosaurs in it as well. There's dinosaurs. What? There are dinosaurs and sea monsters and supernovas and parades and malt shops and mowing the lawn, as well as comets and asteroids. It's an experience, and it all makes sense, and it feels like a love letter to God, where every single thing, like all of the narration that you hear, narration is used heavily in Terrence Malick's films. Every narration is a prayer, and once you realize that, you just close your eyes and just take it in. And Tree of Life was one of his most ethereal films. One of his first films, his first feature length, was Badlands, and that had Martin Sheen and Sissy Spacek in it, and that was made in 1973. He has stuck to his style. That movie is kind of like an art house version of Bonnie and Clyde. It's great. And then you move on to Days of Heaven, which has a young Richard Gere and Sam Shepard. It takes place in the Texas Panhandle again, and it's about harvesting crops. And the cinematography in Terrence Malick's films are by far the most beautiful thing in all of his movies. In 1978, that's his last film until 1998. That's a bigger gap than Kubrick ever had.
Yeah.
And then he follows it up with a war film, The Thin Red Line.
Oh, that was him?
That was him.
Huh.
And that could be one of the greatest war films of all time. That was an introspective war film. It wasn't like Full Metal Jacket or Platoon, where it's just like, war is hell, you know, like, oh, I just can't stand this anymore. This is even more introspective than Full Metal Jacket and Platoon, where it is, why are we doing this? Why are we as human beings doing this to one another? Not just why are Americans doing this to Japanese, or why are Germans doing this to Polish, you know, or anything like that. It's why is one human killing another?
Mm-hmm.
And it's on that base level. And it's just some of the war scenes don't have any sound. It's just straight up music. Music and narration over war scenes. It's fantastic. And then from Thin Red Line, you move on, and he doesn't come out with another film until 2005. And that's The New World. And The New World got a lot of criticism because that was something that the people couldn't really grasp onto. Like with Thin Red Line, we're like, oh, bam, war movie. Okay, came out in the 90s, war film. And with The New World, it's like, okay, this is the story of Pocahontas, but is this really the story of Pocahontas? What is going on here? You know, this is very much an art film where it shows an untouched America, and it shows the British establishing a colony in America and their relationship with the Aboriginals, and it shows it in a whole different way that you've ever seen before. And I know I'm talking for a long time, and I'm going through his films one by one, but it's just, these films, they speak to me. They take stories that you've seen a million times, but they show it to you in a way that you never have before. And I think that is why he's one of the greatest filmmakers of all time.
Well, you managed to do that without filming into a lot of film school pretension, Tristan. Although, I gotta say, you did come close to Will Ferrell as James Lipton when you said that Tree of Life was a letter to God.
As we could all say, the Tree of Life is clearly
a letter
to God.
To God.
To God. Yeah, I know. I know. I've made my peace with it. I mean...
No, I really loved your explanation, and it makes me curious at the very least. I think that, especially given your description of Tree of Life, if we ever get together, I should get really drunk and we should watch that movie together and see what I make of it.
And, you know, like, he's coming out with, it's really funny because, like, he's known for taking such long breaks in between films, and after Tree of Life, he came out with To the Wonder in 2012, and he is coming out with Knight of Cups and Weightless, which were shot back-to-back but are different movies. He's also coming out with another film, which is in post-production right now, Voyage of Time. And we're getting into a Terrence Malick boom, and because we're getting more of him, there's more criticisms of him as well, and more people saying, oh, he's repeating himself. So it's kind of funny because, you know, like, you stay in the shadows long enough, you build up that mystique. And then once you start exposing yourself and your work more and more, you get more and more criticism.
Right. It was very interesting to hear you talk about that. I'm curious to see some of these films now.
All right. Well, I promise to speak much, like, even though I have two and one left, I'm going to speak much shorter on those people because this is already going on a long time.
Yeah, unfortunately. Well, I think the listeners will like that this is a longer show, but my number three is someone who was, I guess, bound to show up on one of my lists eventually, just because I growing up, I loved so much of his films. And this is one director where I think about his film record, and there isn't too much that I don't like. There's some of the stuff that I like more than others, but this person's never made a film where I just went, that was a piece of garbage. You know what I mean? And the person I'm talking about is someone you and I have talked about at length, and that's James Cameron.
Ah, yes, yes. I thought he was going to be your number one.
So James Cameron is number three, and I'm thinking through his list, and I'm not counting the stuff that he did as someone for hire in his early days, but starting with Terminator, that original Terminator, there's not a single movie I can think of where I went, I hated that movie. Because, you know, you got Terminator, you got Aliens. I didn't mind The Abyss more than a lot of other people.
Freaking love The Abyss.
And I thought it was interesting at the very least. Terminator 2 is obviously a classic. True Lies is underrated. It's probably, like, I really love that film so freaking much. Mm-hmm. And Titanic and Avatar have their problems, and I think a lot of it got built up, given how much buzz both of those films got, and a lot of people thought it was overpraise, you know, again, akin to my opening statement for Mad Max, but even those films I didn't hate. I didn't walk out thinking, I freaking hate James Cameron. But so you know, that's for someone to never make a film that I was inherently just disgusted with, I think that's a pretty big accomplishment. And those handful of movies that he did in his early days, Terminator, Aliens, I'll put Abyss in there, Abyss, Terminator 2, and True Lies, those are five amazing films for me. Like, I could watch any of those films right now and I will never get sick of them. So, and he just, things I like about him is that, yeah, his style might be a little same, and you could tell when it's a James Cameron movie, but he uses archetypes that I like. Mm-hmm. And especially with those early films, he reused a lot of actors that I like. I mean, like, there's a reason I'm kind of fond to this day of Arnold Schwarzenegger when he makes a lot of crap films. It's because I really liked him in his James Cameron stuff. I mean, I love Bill Paxton. He's one of my favorite people. Whenever he pops up in any film, I get a little bit happier. You know, he's just one of those actors for me that I just love seeing in anything. But he shines in James Cameron's stuff.
And he's hysterical in True Lies.
Exactly. Like, you know, it's just the stuff that I love. And even, you know, Michael Biehn in both Terminator and Aliens is a fantastic action hero. And the thing that I think that I'm underselling, and the thing that I love most, and the thing that a lot of people, again, are crediting Mad Max with as if it's original, he's the one who made the best action heroines for me. I mean, between Ellen Ripley and Sarah Connor, and I will even go out of my way to say Jamie Lee Curtis by the end of True Lies, and Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio in The Abyss. Like, these are women you don't cross by the end. Even the bad people, in, like the bad guys in his films. I'm thinking of True Lies. What's her name? She was in Tia Carrera. In True Lies. Just love it. Love the way he obviously likes seeing his action females the way I like seeing them. And like, he's never written a bad female character in an action film, at least for me. So that I really give him full marks for. He was doing it when it was not cool to do it. Now it's cool to do it.
You're absolutely right. I mean, like, I go back and forth with James Cameron. I mean, he has made so much money for the industry. He's made solid films, and I don't hate any of his movies. I mean, you're absolutely right. Every single movie that he's made, I think is a good film. But there's something about James Cameron where his scripts, his dialogue, where I'm just like, argh! You know, like, I it's not enough for me to say he's a bad director, because he's not. He's a fantastic director. He's one of the best. But because there are so many moments in his scripts where I'm just like, oh, really? That's the dialogue choice you wanted to go with?
But they're bad, but not, they can be bad, but not in a horrible way. Like, they're very 80s, and they're kind of corny, but they're fun corny. You know what I mean? Like, when Arnold Schwarzenegger shoots that guy off the missile at the end of True Lies, and he says, "You're fired," that's terrible, but it's hilarious.
Oh man, True Lies, that is a good movie. I grew up on that movie. I watched it like three times a month.
For me, it gets lost in his filmography, and it's criminally underrated. Loved the hell out of that film.
Oh man, there were so many rumors that there were going to be a second one, and I was so hoping that would happen. But
I don't know. Unless he did it, I wouldn't want it, because only he. You notice this too. Only he can make good sequels to his films. If someone sequelizes one of his films and it's not him, it doesn't tend to be as good.
Well, we'll find out if that stays true with Avatar 2, 3, and 4.
Right.
All right. Okay. So moving on to my number 2. No surprise here, and that is Christopher Nolan.
I'm shocked.
You even mentioned him earlier. You're like, I might be ruining some of your list. This is another one of those directors like Jim Cameron where he has a very small filmography. He chooses wisely on what he wants to do and when he wants to do it. Now, granted, he hasn't been around as long as some of the other people on this list. Not at all, because his first film was in 1999, and his first major film was in 2001. He is a perfect director for me, and let me qualify that. And I said for me, not a perfect director. I'm saying he is a perfect director for me, because I feel like he blends all of the key aspects of what I find entertaining. He blends fantastic writing, direction, cinematography, editing, and spectacle. He puts that all together, and I think in one neat little package. And he's big on practical effects, which we talked about earlier in our podcast. All of that mixed together. I love his color palette. I love what he gets out of his actors. Now, this does not mean that I am in love with everything that Christopher Nolan does. There are certain times I don't like his casting choices at all. Okay? I hopefully believe that he does not do a good job casting women. It is always 50-50 on casting women.
I knew Anne Hathaway was coming up somewhere in this conversation.
Oh, man, Anne Hathaway,
A person that I love, but again, yeah. We established that you dislike good things.
No, this is not one of those times you get to say that. Because I love Chris Nolan, and it's just, we're talking Katie Holmes, Maggie Gyllenhaal, Scarlett Johansson, Anne Hathaway. These are not actresses I like, and this is not a feminist issue. This is not me trying to make it into a feminist issue. It just so happens to be that he does a horrible casting job when it comes to women, and I don't know why. Again, I'm not criticizing women in film. I'm not criticizing the female roles in these films, because I think a lot of these females' roles are fantastic and not vapid or airheaded or pointless. He has very strong female characters, but I do not think he does a good job of picking strong female actresses. That's just me. But Anyway, Memento is mind-blowing. I mean, it's unique.
You count Carrie Ann Moss in there?
Carrie Ann Moss. I like Carrie Ann Moss. I do think she was probably one of the weaker people of that film, but I do like her. I think once we got Hilary Swank in Insomnia, I was just like, oh, God. It was just downhill from there.
I knew that was in there. I guess without saying.
It just it hit its peak with Katie Holmes in Batman Begins.
No, because it hit its peak for you with Maggie Gyllenhaal, because somehow you find her worse, and that's inexplicable.
No, I find Katie Holmes much worse than Maggie Gyllenhaal.
Oh, really? I could have sworn when we talked a few years ago it was the other way around.
No, not at all. No, not at all. I made a joke one time about how in after Maggie Gyllenhaal's character dies in The Dark Knight, we see a photo of her in The Dark Knight Rises. Like, he's just holding a framed photo of her, and he's just, like, lamenting her passing. Yeah. And I said, wouldn't that be hysterical? Like, if it was Katie Holmes in that photo instead
Wouldn't it have
of...
been even more hysterical if he had two pictures, and one was Katie Holmes, and the other was Maggie Gyllenhaal, and they're supposed to be the same person?
Or on top of that, you just made me think of something. If it was a third actress, like a well-known actress, like it was Scarlett Johansson, somebody that he's worked with before, and yeah. Somebody goes, who's that? I was like, oh, that's Rachel Dawes. I lost her in the last film. Anyway, so like we have his first movie following, second, Memento, Insomnia, Batman Begins, The Prestige, The Dark Knight, Inception, The Dark Knight Rises, Interstellar. Now, everybody who's listened to this knows I'm a huge Batman fan. Huge Batman fan. And Christopher Nolan is not what made me a Batman fan, okay? I've been a Batman fan ever since the womb. But the thing is, The Dark Knight, that is the greatest superhero film ever made. And I'm including everything, okay? The Dark Knight is on another level. The Dark Knight is the superhero film in which all other superhero films should be judged. There we go.
Easy
said
there.
It.
Easy there, internet, though.
I know. People are going to hate on me, and that's okay. I understand.
No, people are not going to hate on you. That's still the popular opinion going, even 7 years later.
I've seen a lot of people who... there's a backlash, kind of like Titanic had, where Titanic was the greatest film in a lot of people's mind, and then all of a sudden it became fashionable to hate Titanic. I feel like we're kind of starting to have that again, where Chris Nolan was praised a great deal for what he did for the Batman franchise, and then because it became such a massive hit and it raised so much money, it then became fashionable to hate on him and his Batman franchise.
I want to say though that happened more as a result when that really came more into being when The Dark Knight Rises didn't live up to everybody's expectations for it, which is unfortunately, you know, even though I wasn't of the same opinion about The Dark Knight, I don't like it when that happens to people. Mm-hmm. Like, it's happening with Joss Whedon now because of Age of Ultron and saying that all of his films were never any good. That's real disingenuous.
It's a low blow, and it's dishonest is what it is. And I love how original Chris Nolan can be. He brings original projects to the table. In this day and age, that is incredibly rare. Because, you know, Memento was original, Prestige, Inception, and Interstellar was original. And it's like, granted, like some people might argue that there are elements of Inception that were ripped off of an anime, but okay, fine, whatever. That's fine if you want to say that. But, you know, like so many people, like you brought up auteur, you know, like so many people say like, oh, only auteurs can be considered great directors. That's bullcrap. But Chris Nolan is definitely a person in that aspect where he writes a lot with his brother, and it just gives us, I like original sci-fi, I like original, you know, like Prestige is sci-fi, and Inception is sci-fi, and Stellar is sci-fi, and it's just, Dark Knight is comic book, and so it's just, he started off with Following and Memento and Insomnia, and then boom, as soon as he hit Batman Begins, he becomes this fantasy sci-fi icon.
I think it threw me off with Prestige, though, if I'm honest with you. I wasn't too up on that film only because you said it's sci-fi, but the unfortunate thing is you don't realize it's sci-fi until almost the end.
Yeah, right.
And I was like, that was too late for that kind of a twist for me, but that was just me.
It's kind of like in Sunshine. Have you seen Danny Boyle's Sunshine?
No, but I should, because Chris Evans is in it.
It's a really good film. Chris Evans does a good job. He's just kind of there, but he does a good job. It's a sci-fi movie that kind of tricks you into watching a horror film.
Right. I've heard that about it, actually. But
and that's kind of like how it is with Prestige, where it's a period piece that tricks you into watching a sci-fi film. And I'm a big Christian Bale fan, and so I'd have to be if I'm going to be a Chris Nolan fan. He just does a great job, and he hits it out of the park. There's not a single movie on this list that I absolutely hate. And The Dark Knight Rises came close, but the more that I watch it, the more I enjoy it.
I doubt it even came that close to you.
It probably didn't. Yeah, it didn't come close to me hating it, but it was definitely disappointing.
You could say it was on the lesser of his spectrum of films.
There you go. There you go. All right. What is your number two?
God, we're really going long, but this is fun. I like this topic.
Yeah, we are. Sorry for going long, folks, but I mean, when we talk about our favorite directors, it's going to go long.
It's fun. Well, your number two is no surprise, and my number two is no surprise because he was bound to show up eventually. I've talked about him multiple times. John Carpenter.
Yeah.
I know that he's a very, very niche filmmaker, and I understand that, which is why I'm including him on my favorites rather than the best of all time. But the films that he's done that I've grown up with and watched countless times again and again and again, I'm passionately in love with these films, which is a weird thing to say, but I am. And there's something about the way he's very good at setting mood for me. And sometimes the tone of a movie can really make or break it, especially when you're dealing with horror. I think that when you're dealing with a horror film, tone, getting the right tone is essential. It's half the battle to making a good flick. And I've talked about Halloween multiple times, but even stuff with The Fog and The Thing, and I just saw They Live, which I thought it was fantastic. That's more of a sci-fi film, but it's still kind of like a body snatchers film. Mm-hmm. There's something about the way he sets tone. He does his own music, which his music is phenomenal. I love the tracks that he does. It's very, very, they're super 80s, of course, but there's something just like, I've said this before, if there's someone that I wanted to, I want to score my life, it's John Carpenter. Just because he makes songs, music that I have in my iPod, and I have some soundtracks on my iPod, but not a whole ton. But his stuff I love. Like, I can't explain it. It's very minimalistic. Some would even say it's repetitive, but there's something about the way he writes music that just goes well with the scene that he presents them in.
Yeah.
And when you can have a piece of music become so identified with a great scene that you love, it becomes that much higher to you. And again, he works with he's kind of like James Cameron too, in that the fact that he reuses a lot of actors in his films, and they're actors, you know, some of them who went on to major careers. I mean, Jamie Lee Curtis is in Halloween and The Fog. Right. Kurt Russell is in Escape from New York and The Thing. I mean, these are those are them at the beginning of their careers. He discovered some really good talent. He made some really good mood pieces. And again, like I said, they're fully niche. He's not a director I recommend to everybody. His films just really blew me away. And I'm at a loss for words because I think I've said it all on multiple podcasts. But he's just a director that I will always love. Even if he doesn't work that much anymore, even if the quality of his films has declined since the 80s, the stuff that he did in the 70s and 80s was so good to me that I'll always hold him in high regard.
Yeah, I definitely expected him on your list, and you're right. I mean, I have no idea who your number one is going
to
be.
Well, like I said, he's a niche director, so it's not like it's one that I can recommend to everybody. But I know that there's people listening. In fact, there's a couple people listening who I know are Carpenter fans, and they'll get it. This section will be for them.
All right. Well, this brings us to number one. We're rounding third here. Number one for me. Just say it for me. Say it for me.
Is it any surprise? He used it as the clip. He's talked about it ad nauseum. If they were both gay, they would marry each other.
And who is that? Say it.
It's David Fincher.
That's right. David Fincher is my number one. You know what, like for a long time, not a long time, but you know, like for a while, there was this time when I was just like, and he was like, okay, who do I like more? Chris Nolan, David Fincher. But
I have a hard time believing that time ever existed.
It's hard because in 2008, Dark Knight came out. And also in 2008, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button came out. Now, The Dark Knight is by far better than Curious Case of Benjamin Button. But 2008 is kind of the beginning of this new age Fincher that we got. Because he took a break from 2002 to 2007 between Panic Room and Zodiac. Panic Room and Zodiac, I would say, are definitely two of his weaker films. And so I really think that he kind of took some time to find himself, kind of readjust where he wanted to go. And I appreciate that. And he tested the waters with Zodiac when it came to special effects and digital filmmaking, everything like that. And then he went full force with Benjamin Button. There's just something so tangible about Fincher's style. about how he moves the camera and how, like, his color palette and the actors that he chooses to work with at the time that he chooses to work with them. His selection of scripts that he gathers. I mean, he once said that he's made his living off of believing that people are perverts.
I could see that.
It's so true. Yeah. Like with the exception of Benjamin Button, I mean, you know, and maybe Social Network, if depending on how you look at it, it's very much true. And obviously, like, he started out in a franchise that both you and I adore, Alien 3.
Mm.
And a lot of people would like to erase Alien 3 from history, including David Fincher.
Well, he and I can agree on something then.
I'm surprised he ever worked with Fox again. He worked with Fox with Fight Club as well as Gone Girl. So I'm really surprised that he ever worked with him again, because he hated the studio interference that went on in that picture. Because the reason why I don't blame Fincher for Alien 3, because...
Oh, I don't blame him. Let's make that clear.
I'm not saying that you do. The reason why I don't blame him is because right after that, he came out with Seven.
Right.
Seven came out in 1995. It is still being analyzed and dissected and taught about.
And can I just say, for my money, so far, as much as I really liked Gone Girl, Seven is still my favorite David Fincher film, by far.
Oh, I mean, Seven is one of the best examples of a David Fincher film. I mean, the performances and the editing and his blocking, like, that's one key thing about David Fincher that I haven't talked about yet, is the blocking of his characters, how he frames a scene. His mind is working on a level that you and I could never reach, because he is organizing, and just the turn of a head, the flip of a switch, the movement of a hand, that all means something in the David Fincher film. He takes a lot of takes and he shoots for a very long time and he gets a lot of criticism for it, but his films are aesthetically near perfect. It's the reason why is because he is formulating everything in pre-production as well as in post-production, as well as in production, because he does not believe in, oh, we'll fix it in post. He fixes a lot of things in post and he pushes it to the limit. He is not scared to fix things in post. But if he can fix something on the day, on set, he's going to do it then. It's something that is lost in a lot of modern filmmakers. You see so many parallels, like from the beginning of a movie to the end of the movie, about how a person moves from left to right tells you something about the story and about how the character is in their own head. That's how minute he gets, and I think that's why he's number one on my list. And also, he just makes kick-ass movies.
He does. I've grown to appreciate him more as I've gotten older. He's not one of those films that I think I could have gotten when I was 12 or 13. Maybe some kids today could, but back then I couldn't. Now, but I didn't see Seven until I was like 20. Mm-hmm. But when I saw it, I was at the right age where, yes, that is a great movie. I've seen Fight Club. I liked Fight Club okay. I haven't quite drunk the Kool-Aid when it comes to that movie, but I did think it was good. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. I liked Panic Room more than you did, probably, and same goes for Zodiac.
Yeah.
But then again, I remember watching Zodiac when it came out and thinking, oh, that's Robert Downey Jr. I kind of liked him in this movie. I hope he's in something again.
Yeah, I hope that guy makes it okay.
Well, I knew he would make it okay, but like that 2007 is just the year before he became Tony Stark, and I was like, I hope I get to see more of him in something sometime.
I liked Zodiac, but I recognize that it's one of his weaker films. I actually do enjoy it, and the more I watch it, the more I enjoy it, but it is not beloved like some of his other films.
Right, and for me, Gone Girl got better with it, as time has moved past.
Same here.
As I thought more about it and saw it again.
And also with Dragon Tattoo, if you guys haven't seen Dragon Tattoo, watch it. That is an amazing film. That's in my top five.
Would you say that, considering how much you love David Fincher and how much you talk about that particular movie, would that be your favorite of his entire oeuvre of films?
Yes. Yes. Dragon Tattoo is my favorite of Fincher's films, and it's one of my favorite films of all time, and which is really hard because Fight Club, in my opinion, changed the world, and I understand how some of you might be thinking that's hyperbole. It's not. And I could go into another podcast as to why it has changed the world, but...
It kind of is hyperbole, but we'll let you have that.
But Dragon Tattoo is a solid film with a solid story. And I've read the novel, I've read the comic book, I've seen the Swedish version, and I've seen the American version. And the American version is better than the novel. I said it. It's true. It's there. I know I'm going to get a lot of hate from that. Even though, like, people just want to put their fingers in their ears and say, like, no, it's not better than Swedish version. It's not better than Swedish version. It is. Okay? It is. I said this online a couple of days ago. I would give up Star Wars. I would give up Batman versus Superman. I would give up any Avenger sequel if it meant I could get a Dragon Tattoo sequel. That's where I am right now. But give us your number one.
If they're going to do it, they might as well do it soon before Rooney Mara can't play a girl anymore.
I know. It's probably not going to happen, and that's okay. But here we are.
Okay, my number one. I kind of feel like I've built it up too much, but I don't think it's the person that you would have thought would have been my number one. I would have bet a lot of people would have thought Carpenter or Cameron would have been my number mm-hmm. one. Being that I'm someone who, obviously, from listing Cameron and Carpenter, the one thing they've done well is suspense, in my opinion. A lot of their films have kept a high level of tension going and presented a certain level of intrigue. And that's something that I discovered from a young age that I really, really liked in films, especially when it came to thrillers and horror. It's not so much the gore, it's the feeling of suspense, it's the feeling of tension. Again, that's why I think something like The Shining works. It's not a gory film, but it's a descent into madness that's just fun to watch. So my number one is someone who is, I think, rightfully credited with creating a lot of that suspense in the first place. And it's someone that's held up a lot in horror circles, filmmaker circles. And even though I haven't seen all of his films, he has a lot. So don't shoot me, because it's kind of impossible to watch all of his films at one time. But the ones I've seen have left an impact on me so much, and I think changed so much so that the films that came later were possible, that I can't think of anyone who else I could elevate to my number one. And so my number one is Alfred Hitchcock.
Oh, okay. I was thinking you were going to say, like, Wes Craven or something.
No, because the stuff that I mentioned came, Wes Craven came after Carpenter.
Oh, okay. I missed that part. But that, hey, solid choice.
His films, well, his bigger films came after Carpenter. But no, none of the, there would be no Wes Craven. There would be no John Carpenter. There would be no Shining-esque Stanley Kubrick had there not been Alfred Hitchcock. And, you know, I've talked about Psycho multiple times. What hasn't been said about Psycho that hasn't been talked about in the last 55 years since it came out? The fact that it's still a classic movie 55 years later says something. But I've seen other films of his, too, and he creates such interesting, like, offbeat, quirky characters and puts them in situations that are very tense and suspenseful. And I love all of them. Like, Rear Window is one of my favorite films from him. Like, mm-hmm. maybe of all time. I might even like that more than Psycho. I have to think about it. But even stuff that's not as well known. He did a film in 1948 or 47 called Rope. That is a film that got a lot of buzz at the time for its unique style, because he shot all of it in 10-minute takes. So 10 minutes of film, and then he would zoom in on someone's, or like, to make the camera black, and then another 10 minutes where it was just nothing but straight shots. Mm-hmm. And that was cool about it, but I really was taken by the story. And I think a theme of my favorite directors are that they reuse a lot of actors that I like. And he did that a lot too. I mean, he worked with James Stewart, Grace Kelly, Tippi Hedren. I love the birds. But he just had this way of creating an atmosphere, and there's a reason he's called the master of suspense to this day. And if you heard him talk, if you've seen any biopic on him, he was such a weird, interesting guy. Mm-hmm. And you could see how in that weird, crazy mind of his, all of this stuff was born. And, you know, I don't think horror would be quite the same today without him, so that's the reason why I'm going to put him as my number one.
I think for you, that makes perfect sense. I think with as much as you love the horror genre, you have to, you know, you have to give props to the person who so many horror people, horror filmmakers draw influences on. And I mean, like, even with his non-horror films. Like,
yeah, I was going to say, like, he made some great, like, North by Northwest is an amazing spy thriller.
phenomenal, phenomenal movie to catch a thief. And yeah. then, in heck, I mean, in 1944, you have a lifeboat. If you ever want to learn how to shoot a movie in a cramped space, watch Lifeboat.
Lifeboat is incredible. I'm so glad you brought that up.
Yeah. I
mean, that talk about a minimalist cast and a minimalist setting.
Yeah. I think you gave great reasoning and great examples. And I am so happy that out of our list of 10 directors, that you gave someone who was a non-modern filmmaker. Because... It's easy to love what's hip and what's new, or at least what's going on in your own lifetime. And there needs to be more love for the people who started it all, or at least who, not saying Hitchcock started it all, but you know what I'm saying. Like,
well, like you said, for horror, he did start it all. Him and the Universal Monster people started it all.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Solid choices. Well, that is our show. We went on for a long time. This has to be our absolute longest show. I'm sweating because podcasting is so hard.
I know.
It's I think just as a review, my list goes Wes Anderson, Martin Scorsese, Terrence Malick, Christopher Nolan, and then David Fincher. What about you?
And then mine went Steven Spielberg, Stanley Kubrick, James Cameron, John Carpenter, Alfred Hitchcock.
And my honorable mentions real fast, no reasoning. My honorable mentions in no particular order: Ridley Scott, Richard Linklater, Alfonso Cuarón, Tim Burton.
We almost match pitch for pitch because I put in there Ridley Scott, Richard Linklater, but I also included in there J.J. Abrams just because I had to.
That's so great. That's so great that we match so closely. All right. Thank you so much for listening. You guys have a great day. And please go to thenerdparty.com. Email us at contact@thenerdparty.com. Go to our Facebook page at facebook.com/thenerdparty. List your top five favorite directors. We want to know. Instead of saying, oh my God, I can't believe you guys didn't put so-and-so on your list. No, tell us your top five.
Absolutely. And you can reach me personally at mhanson0207 on Twitter.
And you can also find me at The Insane Robin.
So thank you so much for joining us for the Nerd Party. And until next time, that's a wrap.
Coming up next week.
Since the beginning of time, man has searched the earth for evidence of his past. But while some have looked for clues to the mystery, one man has found the way to bring the mystery back to life.
I own an island. The coast of Costa Rica. And I spent the last 5 years setting up a kind of biological preserve.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
Another naked pic request. Why doesn't he stop? I know, he just keeps on and on and on. Maybe I should just send him one?
No way.
He said I could trust him.
Heard that before.
Look what happened to, what's her name? Some guy shared her pic and it broke the internet. Everyone saw it. Her parents, her teachers. Poor girl.
He's getting well desperate.
Ugh, forget him.
No one should be pressured into sending a naked picture. To find out more, search Disrespect Nobody.